Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Megan Culp, along here with Scott Micklin.
Good morning. It is Thursday, April 22nd, 2021.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
Week 58, right?
I think so. Yeah. We'll find out. We'll see if we get confirmation of that. But here we are, week 58.
Yep.
Welcome, everyone, to our COVID-19 Community Information Program here on KSJE. We're glad that you are with us. We have a great program planned for you today. We're going to be talking to our local doctors because we've been hearing a lot about the COVID vaccines, the pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And so our thought was, why don't we talk to the local doctors and see what's behind all that?
Right.
And
why don't we stop conjecturing and
right.
ask people who know things?
Exactly, which is the whole point of the show.
That's the whole point of the show.
So they are coming on in the next few minutes, so we're so grateful for their time and expertise and information because they really explain it so that, well, so I can understand it and you can understand it. But if they can explain it so that I can understand it, they've done a great job.
That's what I'm trying to say. That is the litmus test.
That is. Yes. So they are coming on. Then we're going to talk about the horrible, horrible problem of child abuse during this whole pandemic. And our guests from Child Haven will be talking a little bit about their efforts to deal with that and how they're helping families and reaching out and dealing with reports of child abuse. And this is actually Child Abuse Awareness Month.
Yes.
So the month of April. So we're going to do that in addition to the rest of the stuff that we always talk about. So we're get right to it. But we're glad that you are with us, everyone, as I mentioned. So we will start off with the news from yesterday, of course, which is that San Juan County remains in yellow for the second 2-week period in a row. There we were very close, and I'll show you in just a minute how close we were to going back to red, like Colfax County did. They're the county in red that you see on the map, but we did not. And so San Juan County remains in yellow. As you can see from the map, of course, that McKinley County is still in turquoise. Bernalillo County remains in yellow as well. I believe Santa Fe County is in turquoise, and many other counties along the eastern side of our state, which are fairly low population counties, I should say, are also in turquoise. And of course, Las Cruces is in yellow again as well. But taking a look at the numbers, and of course, to get to green, we had to have cases less than 8 per 100,000 and a test positivity rate less than 5%. Our cases per 100,000 last 2 weeks were 17.7. So they were way off of that. And our positivity rate that had to be under 5 was 4.93.
By the skin of our teeth.
Yeah. That would have pushed us back to red.
Yeah.
If it had gone over, if it was 5.01, because we know how the state is, they don't round up or down. So
no rounding. Yeah. Well, in this case, it's good they don't round up.
That's right.
So
that's what I mean.
There's
so
that.
You live by the decimal, you die by the decimal. Apparently, so
you've never
heard that before.
That's what I always say.
It's on a T-shirt you wear all the time. So there you go. Anyway, so we're in yellow, but in watching the press conference yesterday from the state, from Dr. Scrace and the health department director, they were saying that they are getting ready to modify some of that gating criteria that they have been using for the last 14 months. And so they were hopeful to get that out for the next map update, which will be in 2 weeks. So we're going to work on trying to get someone from the state on the show next Thursday to explain what that will mean to the state and specifically to San Juan County, because they did point out that they are hoping that these modifications would help larger counties in our state, like Bernalillo, like San Juan, like Doña Ana. And so we are hopeful that that is the case. They didn't think that it would, these changes would push any county back anymore in the stages. So no one's going to go to red with this new criteria.
Right.
So
okay.
They say.
Gotcha.
We'll see. Right?
Time will tell.
Exactly. Exactly. Let's talk about vaccines, right? So again, New Mexico has opened up the vaccines now. We are in, I think, well into phase 2. And certainly everyone in the earlier phases are encouraged to sign up and get a vaccine. As the state announced, self-scheduling now for anyone 40 years and older. In our state, we are also still one of the top vaccinated states in the country, if not the leading state in the country. We'll show you in just a minute, though, that San Juan County is not quite at the top of the list when it comes to counties in our state, as far as vaccination rates. So there's still that. Seniors and those with disabilities can call 800-432-2080 to help get a vaccine scheduled or to register for your vaccine. But they are moving, I think, pretty quickly through those lists of folks that are signing up to schedule a vaccine. Mm-hmm. So that is important. Again, vaccinenm.org is the website.
Yes.
To sign up for. And the number, again, also to help with vaccination, 855-600-3453. Option 0 for vaccine questions. Option 4 for tech support from the state. And so here's the map from the state's COVID-19 vaccination map. A lot of folks look at the testing map that we show you, like the yellow, red, green, turquoise map. But there's also a vaccine map. And so you can see on the vaccine map, San Juan County is green, but we're not the dark green. That's the counties, and darker green are the ones that are kind of leading the state when it comes to the percentage of population with the vaccine. We can zoom in and see that 44.1% of San Juan County residents have at least one shot of the COVID vaccine. 34.7 of us are fully vaccinated in San Juan County, but the percent of residents registered with the state to get the vaccine are only 26.5%. Mm. So that's not going to get us to herd immunity.
No,
at 26%.
It's not.
So if you're able to, I would say register to get your vaccine. If you still have questions about the vaccine, by all means, do your research and get your questions answered.
You should actually probably get them answered in this show.
We hope we will be able to answer some of them in this show in the next few seconds. Yeah. But in the meantime, we're still not quite where we need to be across the state. And so, again, the rest of the state is doing a little better, as we showed you on the map, than in San Juan County. They have higher registration rates, higher vaccine rates, and things like that. But I know we had folks outside San Juan College this morning getting vaccines across the street. So that is a good thing. So shall we talk to the doctors?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. Joining us this morning to talk a bit about the COVID vaccines and also some of the news that we are hearing in the media about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Once again, I would say they have to be our favorite doctors from San Juan Regional Medical Center, right?
And
friends of the show.
Yeah.
Dr. Aaron Philpott and Dr. Brad Greenberg from San Juan Regional Medical Center are on the phone with us this morning. And good morning, doctors.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us.
Good morning.
Again.
You bet. It's great to have you both with us. And Megan, do you want to get us started?
Sure. So let's talk Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We know that there's been a pause on its use because of blood clot concerns. There were 6 cases of blood clots. And so, Dr. Greenberg, why don't you kick us off in explaining that to us a bit more?
Absolutely. So as everyone is probably aware, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was paused. I think it was on the 12th of April. And what happened is that they had noticed that in the, I think, over 6.8, approximately 7 million cases of Johnson & Johnson vaccine administered, there were 6 cases reported of what's called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis in conjunction with very low levels of platelets. And so that's a pretty rare clinical entity. And so they had basically expressed some concern about that and noticed those things were going on, and there was some consideration about whether or not those particular blood clots were either reflective of what we call a background rate or really the normal rate of a rare medical problem in the population, or if they were higher because of the recent receipt of the Johnson & Johnson vaccination. So all 6 of those cases actually occurred in women between the ages of 18 and 48. And they seem to occur between 6 and 13 days after vaccination. And it's a significant clinical entity. And also, there was another element to this. We do see different incidents of what we call cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. It's a rare clinical entity, but really we don't see it in conjunction with very low platelets. And so the low platelets was a new element that was added, which really changed the way that we physicians would approach this kind of problem. And so the pause was largely designed to create a little bit of space for the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, to meet, and they met on the 14th of April, and also an opportunity for a little bit of education and training for physicians to make sure that we recognize this clinical entity and modified our the diagnostics and the treatment associated with it as well. So I think, though, that the pause is also it's actually a very good example of how science is working. And I think that with this pause, the structure, the expert input with this, I believe that it really demonstrates the emphasis on safety for what is really a very rare clinical entity. And so I think it's a great example of the emphasis on safety and capturing every possible complication associated with the vaccine. So that's sort of the background for where we're at.
Very good. Thank you. And Dr. Philbot, I have a follow-up. I know all six of those cases were women, and there was some talk about how, well, birth control can also cause people to throw clots. So is this platelet, this combination of low platelet and the blood clot, is that what separates this from what normally might happen in that situation?
Yeah, Megan, that's exactly right. And that's why these cases have kind of stood out. And as Brad kind of alluded to, this was to also inform the physicians caring for these patients and be able to identify it. We see sort of a similar entity called HIT, heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, that is tied with low platelets and clots. And it looks like this may be a similar mechanism. So you develop some antibodies against platelets. Platelets are a part of our blood component that help clot. So they form clots when you cut yourself, and that's how you your bleeding stops. So in some cases, when we start people on this anticoagulant, heparin, people actually develop these antibodies against these platelets, the platelet levels drop, and then they clump together and they form clots. That seems to be what's happening among these women, which, as you pointed out, is distinctive from the usual cerebral venous sinus thromboses, which typically have normal platelets. And as you can imagine, is really important when we're thinking about treating these patients. Heparin or enoxaparin are first-line medications, and those could actually make these cases worse. So it requires a different type of anticoagulation, which, again, it's really, you know, pausing this vaccine really has put everyone on high alert, meaning that the medical community, the physicians, to tune in and pay attention. And that was, you know, a huge part of the intent of the FDA and CDC to educate us all.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Philpott. And Dr. Greenberg, I wanted to come back to you a little bit about these numbers, because I really want our audiences to understand just this very small percentage of cases that have come up. You mentioned, you know, over 6 million doses, just six cases of this blood clotting problem in just women, right? No men were affected. And so can you talk a little bit about that number? And I guess the greater point maybe is that the science is kind of working as it's designed to work, to be able to look at some of these very small incidents and then take a look. And I think the language saying that they're going to pause the vaccine was very deliberate, not canceling, not stopping, but pausing while we find out more about what exactly is going on. It's a very rambling question to Dr. Greenberg, but I'm hoping you followed it.
It's a great question, but I think that the real key here is that this is science working with incredibly low probabilities. Okay, but you have to, let's remember here, these vaccines didn't exist a year ago. And this is, every single one of these clinical trials, they weren't rushed. They were rigorous and very well-structured and adequately populated scientific trials. And now we're looking at these things, which look like a less than one in a million chance. And I think that there are many, many, many things out there that will, and I think that Dr. Philpott has some numbers related to specific COVID risks as well. I don't have those in front of me, but I think that the key here is about the background rates. Like the normal background rate for things like cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, not including the low platelets or the thrombocytopenia, is somewhere around between 2 and 15 per million. This is already a super rare entity. What we're seeing is, you know, four, say, six cases in 7 million, that the rates of this particular clinical entity might be a little bit higher with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Hence all of the concern, hence the reasons to do the pause. But these numbers are incredibly low, incredibly low. You have a much higher risk of, say, contracting COVID and contracting severe COVID, and, you know, being hospitalized or dying from this than you would having any kind of vaccine reaction of this particular magnitude. I think there's many things where the probabilities for bad things happening to us as you're walking around the world are higher than one in a million.
Well, I agree with that. And I think there's been a lot of conversations about, you know, just driving to get your COVID vaccine, you have a better chance of being injured or hurt than anything from the vaccine.
So, yeah, and so let's broaden out to vaccines in general. Now we're in the last phase, which means everybody 16 and older. There might be some parents out there maybe that have trepidation about vaccinating their adolescents. Can you guys speak to that, some lingering nervousness that's going on? Dr. Philpott, why don't you take it?
Sure, I'll just follow up. I think Brad was making some really good points there about just sort of the risk and the risk tolerance and the possibility or probability of experiencing some of these different side effects or events associated with the vaccines. I think we've been actually remarkably lucky. I don't know if lucky is the right word, but with the mRNA vaccine platforms, we really haven't seen any standout events after vaccinating millions, hundreds of millions of people to date, which is just incredible with such a highly efficacious vaccine. So I think it's been very reassuring. I think these little sort of hiccups or pauses with the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson, again, are very appropriate. And this is what we're pausing for, one in a million cases of this stuff. So we're on a really positive track of evidence for safety at this point. I think comparing sort of these possible side effects versus the possibility of individual risk and death from COVID. I mean, COVID alone increases your risk of thrombus or clot formation. To agree that, you know, I don't have a number in front of me, but I would say it's likely much higher than one in a million based on my experience of caring for hundreds, probably thousands now of COVID cases over the last year. The infection fatality ratio, which is what Brad was just mentioning, for the age group, you know, like to think about the Johnson & Johnson clot risk of one in a million, 18 to 49 age group, and this is males and females, it's 150 people per a million. So we've already had over a million people die from COVID. I mean, half a million of people die from COVID in the U.S. to date. So I think it feels, the decision feels evident. I mean, these are incredibly effective vaccines with very minimal risk associated as vetted to date by all our studies and the large population vaccinated. I think the other thing that Brad and I have talked much about is these evolving variants. And, you know, we can be in a very different situation, a worse one, a year from now, if we don't as a collective get on board and really highly consider these vaccines and developing protection along with all our usual public health measures like social distancing, mask wearing, avoiding big crowds, because it's just the natural course of viruses to evolve, and they will evolve, and they could evolve to start significantly impacting children and kind of outwit us and evade our vaccines. So I think for individuals, there's not a lot of question in my mind of the risk-benefit of getting really any of the approved vaccines to date. And then on, you know, sort of the social contract or working as a collective to get our society back to some semblance of normal, I think it's really important.
Indeed. I agree. Go ahead, Dr. Greenberg, you bet.
I was hoping to add on to that too. I echo Dr. Philpott's comments also. I have one interesting side note about the vaccine platform, and then which is basically that, you know, the AstraZeneca, which went through a whole series of pauses in the EU, and there are sort of variable kind of acceptance with the different countries around the world. Had a similar issue with blood clots, and I think what's very interesting, people are concerned, oh well, this is the platform they're using, this is the attenuated adenovirus, but actually, like in Johnson & Johnson has other adenovirus platforms that are used, for example, like the Ebola vaccine is an adenovirus platform. There is no cerebral venous sinus thrombosis with thrombocytopenia or low platelets or otherwise with those other platforms. So this isn't about the adenovirus. I'm excited to see how the science develops. The other component that I wanted to mention is that the other vaccines, I think Johnson & Johnson is safe, but if you want some really good numbers to feel good about if you're on the fence, is that Pfizer and Moderna have had much larger numbers thus far, and these complications didn't show up in the real world. What we say by that is that you do smaller numbers associated with clinical trials and whatnot, and then the vaccines go out. And, you know, we've had in the United States, just in the United States, 97 million doses of Pfizer and 84 million doses of Moderna. And these complications were not apparent. So these vaccinations are safe. And so I think that it's very, very important that people feel comfortable with it, but also, you know, I think the evidence, what we've seen is that these vaccines, in addition to being safe, they work. And, you know, the breakthrough rates that we have for post-vaccinated cases are very modest and entirely expected. And I think that it's really, really important that anyone who's, well, I would say thank you to anyone who's received their vaccinations and to anyone who's on the fence. It is the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for you, for your family, for your loved ones, and it is the right thing to do for us all together as a society to try to navigate our way out of the pandemic. So I would strongly encourage anyone who is on the fence to first get their questions answered from a source that they trust, and then make that appointment and go get vaccinated.
Very good. Very good. Agreed. And just one quick clarifying question, Dr. Greenberg, the adenovirus, can you give a brief explanation about what that is?
Sure. So there are many, many viruses out there that basically can cause infection. And one of the challenges associated with delivering or making a vaccine work is how to deliver the right kind of material that would generate an immune response to the target cells. And so the mRNA platform, boy, we could, as you guys like to say, we could really nerd out about vaccine delivery platforms right now. But the mRNA platform uses a specific lipid nanomolecule, which then basically attaches to the outside of a membrane, which then delivers the mRNA to the inside of the cell, where then we are able to produce the spike protein. And that causes an immune response. The adenovirus vectors use actually an attenuated virus. So it's a live attenuated virus that delivers that content into the cell as well. So it's really a different mechanism to deliver the same kind of, we would say, immunogenic antigen. So the same kind of material that causes an immune response. So that's what the adenovirus is used for.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Dr. Greenberg. Dr. Philpa, as we kind of wrap up our conversation this morning, I wanted to ask you, and Dr. Greenberg, feel free to chime in as well a little bit about herd immunity. We've talked about that before. Now as vaccines are rolling out, and, you know, we just talked about this a few minutes ago of how important it is to, if we want to get back to doing some of the things we consider normal, like graduations and family reunions and flying and visiting and travel and all those different things, we keep hearing about herd immunity. And it sounds to me, unless all of us get the vaccine or as many of us that can get it as is possible, we're not going to be able to get to herd immunity. And so this may be something that we deal with year in and year out, like a flu vaccine or things along that line. So I guess the question, Dr. Philpott, is, you know, encouraging folks to get the vaccine when they're able to and get as close to that herd immunity, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Scott. I think, you know, early on, we calculate the herd immunity based on sort of the transmissibility of a disease. So we use this R-naught factor. So if a single person can infect 2 to 3 people, which was kind of the initially thought sort of rate of transmission of COVID, then you need about 66% of people or 2/3 of the population vaccinated to achieve herd immunity. I think all bets are off at this point at what number we achieve herd immunity with the more transmissible strains like the 117 and the P2 strain and the various variants. It's a little bit more difficult, but I think the bottom line is exactly as you said, as many vaccinated people as possible is how we're going to get protection. We're not going to achieve this with natural infection alone, without just really a lot of unnecessary death. So I think, yes, everyone who can should hopefully be able to get out there and get vaccinated.
Very good. And Dr. Greenberg, you have anything to add?
I think that I would characterize it as right now we are in a race. And I want everyone to hear that there is a specific urgency to getting vaccinated now. And the thing is that the longer that the virus is able to get out there and to replicate in any given person or host, the more likely it is that variants of concern, which include all the ones that Dr. Philpott mentioned, you know, we try not to link them to geographic areas, and we do the numbers, but we're talking about the same thing. But the thing is that it's not like something exotic happened in South Africa, because there's a variant of concern from California. There's variants of concern that can evolve anywhere, that there's the opportunity for the virus to replicate in a given host. And so what we need to do collectively, what we need to do is get vaccinated and use COVID-safe practices to reduce the likelihood of additional variants of concern and to reduce the likelihood of transmission of variants of concern that are already documented. In those places where people are more vaccinated, when they've done surveillance, breakthrough cases and resurgent clusters are largely from variants of concern. And so where they've done studies like this, for example, in Israel, they've really found it's the B1351, that's the Brazilian variant, or the South Africa variant, which is the B1351. Oh, my apologies. The South Africa variant. So the variants are really the ones that are causing the problems. But unless we all get on board here with this vaccination process and all we stick to these COVID safe practices. I know it's been a long time. I know it's been challenging. I know that it's frustrating. We all want to get back to normal. But normal is not going to happen unless we all stick together and work as a one big team, one big group to try to get out of this. And this is a different challenge. This is a global And this is a global problem, it's a national problem, and it's a local problem. But it's a problem that we're all in the same big community. So please, please get vaccinated, and we can all get out of this together.
Very good. Agreed over here. Well, thank you, Dr. Philpott, Dr. Greenberg. Thanks so much for coming on. As always, we appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you, doctors. Always appreciate it. And there you go. Some good local information from our doctors here on KSJE, back here in the studio. Good information about the vaccines, right?
I know.
A lot of folks are concerned.
There was a moment there where it felt like we were sitting in like hematology 101 class or something.
I think we might we may now have certificates or something.
Yeah, that was some free medical schooling there. Yeah,
definitely. But I always appreciate their time.
Yes.
And the information. So we have two more guests who are joining us this morning, waiting on the phone patiently. They have been waiting patiently for us to get to talk to them. They are from Child Haven, and we are joined by Andrea Pena from the Child Haven Foundation, and also Dana Longinette, who is the director of the Child Haven Children's Advocacy Center. And so good morning to both of you. It's great to have you both on the air with us this morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me. That was awesome. That was so synchronized.
They planned that. They spent 10 minutes on hold practicing.
Yeah. You're not even in the same room. That's impressive.
We work well together. We'll just put it back.
There you go.
So this month is Child Abuse Awareness Month, the month of April. So Andrea, we had you on a year ago, I think, and you were speaking to the problem of, hey, now that schools are not in session, there's a lot of adults that look out for kids that don't have the ability to see what's going on and report. So what is the update there? What are you guys noticing in your work regarding that?
Yeah, I think from when we last spoke about this, we were just noticing at that point, you know, how severe this issue was going to be in regards to child abuse. And throughout the pandemic, we definitely saw how the children not being in school during their normal activities impacted the number of child abuse reporting. But even with that, the numbers were still really high. It was still over 1,000 reports of child abuse in our county. So Dana, if you want to talk to that, Dana's program is really on the front lines of and continue to be on the front lines dealing with that issue. So Dana, anything that you have to contribute to that would be appreciated.
Sure. When COVID started a little over a year ago, we were really concerned, like Andrea said. There were no eyes on the kids. They were not in school, and so there were no reports coming in, which was really scary for us because we're used to having it maybe 10 cases a week or something, and it got down to maybe 5 a month. Now that things are starting to open up a little bit, we're getting really busy because there's now finally eyes on the kids. The cases are horrific. All of them are horrific, but they are more violent than what I've seen in the past.
Interesting. And so, and it's tragic to hear you talk about that, but I guess so important that at least now we're finally finding out about this, and you're finally finding out about this, and law enforcement is finally finding out about this, right?
Yes, exactly. And we work great as a team. The Child Advocacy Center, law enforcement, Child Protective Services, Sexual Assault Services, prosecution, we all work as a great team together to try and make sure that these families and these children, they receive the services that they need and these perpetrators are put away.
Yeah, and so can you briefly describe what's the process look like?
For someone to come in for an interview, is that what you're talking
about? Right, yeah, so you guys get a report, and then what happens?
Yeah, so we get a report, and now COVID days, the advocate will go outside and meet the family and have one non-offending caregiver come in with one child after they do a COVID survey. Everyone has masks on and gowns. And then the interviewer will meet with law enforcement and CPS if they're there, and we will go over the case, kind of talk about it. Then the interview will happen with the child. There is a family advocate that will stay with the non-offending caregiver as the interview is going on and try to help them with referrals, resources, anything that they need help with. The advocate will stay on the case all the way through, even until after prosecution. Some cases I have advocates on for 2 years or so. And then afterwards, you know, law enforcement, they go and type up their report and send it to the DA's office. and then it goes from there.
Thank you. And Dana, you mentioned that the cases that you're hearing about now are just horrific and are certainly much more severe than you've heard maybe before in many cases. And I know the work at the Child Haven Children's Advocacy Center, you have special setup so that a child maybe who's gone through any type of abuse maybe only has to relate their story maybe once or twice, and it's kind of by design, so they don't have to keep repeating it over and over again to counselors and law enforcement and others. Isn't that kind of how it works?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what we want. Even if they are in school and a child discloses in school, we just want that report made to CPS and law enforcement, and then they know to bring the child to us. That way they only have to tell the story one time, and it's recorded, and they're not having to relive it over and over and over and telling the story more than once.
Yeah, that's so, so very important. So I'm happy to hear that. So Andrea, let's switch to the foundation here quickly. First of all, you can tell us what it is. And then also, generally in the spring, I think you guys have your big fundraisers. And then last year we did it virtually. What's that looking like this year?
Yeah, thanks, Megan. So the purpose of the Child Haven Foundation is to secure the programs at Child Haven, so to financially secure those programs, and to ensure that programs that are at Child Haven and other at-risk youth-serving organizations can have security and stability for years to come. And so we're growing the foundation, and we are able to, every year, back Child Haven financially to make sure that the programs that are currently serving children and families can function and can bring the healing and justice that children need. And so the foundation is really important to that. And with COVID, obviously, that impacts events. So, you know, when we're doing fundraisers, we're really wanting to just reach people literally where they are. So we're doing more online things or sending things in the mail to inform people about what's going on at Child Haven and how they can help. I think through some of those people want to do something. And unfortunately, we can't, you know, have a big event like we would wish. So this year we're challenging people to join our walk and roll. So it's the 30th anniversary, more the merrier. And that used to be a bike-a-thon and then a walk-a-thon. So we're kind of combining both, and we're making it a walk and roll and encouraging people on May 21st and 22nd to get outside and do an activity that they enjoy. And we do have registration online for that, and we have sponsorships available right now, and we're hoping people can get behind our cause in this way. And it is exciting still to see people supporting us, and we're very grateful to our community for recognizing this significant need here in San Juan County, and we also serve McKinley County.
That's great. Well, Andrea, thank you very much for sharing that information about the Child Haven Foundation. Dana Longinette, thank you for talking a little bit about the work that you all are doing at the Children's Advocacy Center there at Child Haven. And I would guess if anyone is thinking that maybe a child is the victim of an abusive situation, they can reach out to certainly law enforcement or to Child Haven?
Yes, or to Child Protective Services.
Very good.
They can do Pound Safe from their cell phone.
All right. Good to know. Wonderful. Well, thank you both for calling in this morning and talking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. Our guest this morning from Child Haven here on KSJE and our COVID-19 Community Information Program. Good information.
Hard information.
True.
Yeah.
But so grateful that they are continuing to work and figuring ways around some of these restrictions and getting word about some of these cases.
Yes. Have you ever visited the Child Haven shelter?
Yes. Did we just meet? Yeah, of course I have.
Okay, I have. It's very nice. Is all I wanted to say. So
it is very
just
nice.
Just to add to that. So to your point about good people doing good work, it's a nice comforting environment if a kid is stuck in that situation.
Definitely,
it's awful. At least they have a safe, welcoming
yes.
place.
And across the park at the Children's Advocacy Center, it's another great resource to have, as we showed during the interview, you know, the place where kids can go to only have to tell their story once, and it's not like a police room. It's a more comfortable room, I think, for a child. We showed a picture of that as well. So, again, I think Child Haven does a lot of great work to try to make their surroundings as comfortable as possible when they're talking to kids who've been through some of these horrific, maybe, situations. Mm-hmm. And so we have a picture on the screen right now of kind of what that looks like. So there you go.
Yeah.
So perfect. Well, let's get back to sharing to some of the stats that we've collected over the last week with everybody before we say goodbye. And we will confirm that it is week 58, by the way. We got that confirmed from the calendar queen who, you know,
keeps
notes
us,
it.
Yeah. Keeps us straight.
Exactly. I picture like her kitchen and then she's like scrawling in the wall like every week that goes by. Maybe you think that's how it works?
I think she has one of those fireman calendars.
You think so?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised about that either. But okay. We'll have to give equal time now to her to figure that out. But anyway, very good. Well, let's go back to some of the things I wanted to show. This graphic I thought was really interesting from the state health department about, we talked about vaccines, right? And that San Juan County was not among the highest for vaccinated populations. And so there are 15 counties in the state, though, that do have the percentages of their population over 50% that have been vaccinated against COVID-19. And so there's the map of them on the screen right now, and you can kind of see Bernalillo is on there. Rio Arriba County is on there as well. Doña Ana, though, is not. Neither is San Juan. And Chavez is not, but there's a bunch. Santa Fe is. Taos County is, but there's the list. Los Alamos County is. So there you go. But maybe we can get there by the next week.
Let's hope.
All right. There you go. The watch list, we want to pass that along, of course. These are the numbers of rapid responses from the state that have been going out. Because of COVID cases, the companies on that list now include Hillcorp in Aztec with two rapid responses. The district attorney's office here in Farmington has two rapid responses. Dugan Production in Farmington has two. Farmington Electric Utility has two. Also, Farmington General Services Department, the city's General Services Department, has three. Smith's Food and Drug Center in Farmington has two rapid responses. Aztec High School with two. Of course, we heard that they went back to virtual learning end of last week. Lydia Rippey Elementary in Aztec has two. Country Club Elementary in Farmington with two. Esperanza Elementary with two. Mesa View Middle School with two. And Pedro Vista High School with three. And they also went back to virtual learning last week. And I think that this will explain probably why that happened as well.
Johns Hopkins numbers. So here we are. Cases in the United States are now at 31,862,987. United States confirmed deaths are now at 569,404.
There you go. And again, we always kind of look at that graph in the lower right, and it's kind of leveled out a little bit. Looks like it's maybe dropping, which is good.
Yeah.
But we are hearing about spikes in some parts of the country, so we'll just kind of have to see how that is going. But certainly the cases are not going back up like they were in December,
right,
which is where that big spike is. So we're grateful for that.
Yes.
And I think as the more vaccines get rolled out and more folks opt to take the vaccine when their time is right, then that will help keep those numbers down.
Right.
Is the important thing. In New Mexico, 187 new cases yesterday for a total of 195,783. But look at San Juan County. I did want to make note of this because this is the higher number. We haven't seen daily case counts this high in a long time. 32 new cases reported yesterday in San Juan County for a total of 14,191. There were 10 additional deaths in New Mexico yesterday. None of those in San Juan County. But again, if we want to keep out of the red, 32 cases a day is not the way to do that. Mm-hmm. And so we just have to be very careful, I think, to keep this from spreading.
Stay vigilant.
True. More recoveries, 179 new recoveries for a total of 177,84 in New Mexico. Some of the news stories, of course, that we're tracking at KSJE.com, the San Juan County yellow on the map that was released yesterday, the daily cases, of course, from the state. And take a look at the Navajo Nation. That's notable just because they had eight new cases yesterday, right? 30,388. They had one death yesterday across the reservation, which is tragic. But I want to point out that for 10 days prior to yesterday, there were no deaths. Mm-hmm. On the reservation for 10 days in a row, mm-hmm. which is amazing and wonderful. So again, that is good news. So we appreciate that number as well and that information. Other than that, I'm just looking through. We have a couple other things to share today before we go. Again, today out at Blanco Elementary School, there is a food box distribution from the Echo Food Bank at Blanco Elementary beginning at 4 p.m. So we remind you about that event. Also happening right now out in Nagizi, beginning at 9 a.m. They were having a food box distribution this morning. So there's that information as well. And then tomorrow over in Aztec, Echo Food Bank doing another free food box distribution at the county office building there on South Oliver Drive in Aztec, beginning at 9 a.m. Friday, April 23rd, radio audience. And so we wanted to share that as well.
Very good.
So lots of information. And I think that brings us to the end of our program. That's all we have.
Lots of good information.
No kidding, right? So we appreciate all of our guests. We appreciate you. And we certainly hope that you got some good information out of this. Again, the doctors, always great. The information from Child Haven, always great because of these horrible things that are happening in our community. We wish they weren't, but if they are, we're glad that folks at Child Haven are there to deal with it, along with CYFD and police department.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. All righty. So until next week, I guess, right?
Right.
Share the show and join us again next Thursday, live at 9. Have a great week, everyone. Stay well. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.